My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
We go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabularies. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of the following words? We begin with Dennis Norden. And Dennis, your word is recherché.
Well, the words in this round always are.
Yes. That's a good negative definition.
Something recherché is far out in the negative sense. It's been sought for too long.
Yes. I think that's absolutely dead right, and 2 marks. It's a somewhat dated adjective, I think, isn't it, Dennis? I mean, it has a sort of Victorian ring about it.
It would be... it hasn't. I would think that you could run a boutique called...
That you could probably manage, yeah. 2 marks. And Dennis Powell, schizophrenic.
Schizophrenic. Schizo means split.
Yes.
Schizophrenic means mind. It's something... Mm-hmm. It's somebody, well, it's an adjective meaning with a split mind.
Yes.
Which implies that the person with schizophrenia can be really two people like all of us.
Yes, that doesn't help the doctors to diagnose.
Well, the doctors are inclined to say that a schizophrenic may think he's a jolly nice person on Tuesday, and on Wednesday he can go out and murder somebody.
Yes, he's dissociated from what?
Reality.
Yes, that's what I wanted. Frank Muir, saturnine.
Saturnine?
Mm-hmm.
That's good. It means applicable to people born under the sign of Saturn.
Yes.
Who were lumpish and stupid and cold and unwarmed and unresponsive.
Yes, I think that's...
Leaden.
That's what I wanted.
Well, it also means suffering from lead poisoning.
Quite right. Yes, the medical definition of saturnine is suffering from lead poisoning, yes. And born under Saturn, quite right. Gloomy, dull, glaring, phlegmatic, grave, and all the adjectives which Frank quite accurately used as well. 2 marks. Oh, Anne Scott James, your word is surrogate. SURROGATE, surrogate.
Well, now, if Frank Muir were to, which heaven forfend, get measles when we're next recording My Word, and some inferior wit were to take over, he would be a surrogate wit.
He still get paid.
Is a surrogate unpaid? It's a stand-in, I never thought of it.
No, I think he probably does get paid, though, and I'm not certain he gets paid the full fee.
Well, I think it is a stand-in.
Yes.
For a professional... job.
Yes, I think that's good enough.
In the old days, when a husband couldn't produce a child, he often had somebody who... and that was known as in loco parentis.
I think the less we pursue that line, the better. Because this is somebody appointed by authority to act in place of another as a representative or stand-in. It means to ask for somebody in the place of. It's a Latin word. 2 marks. At this point, I give Frank and Dennis a quotation for them to think about for their stories in the last round. And Frank, yours is, the game is up. And for you, Dennis, a nightingale in the sycamore. Well, round two is a round of literary clues to pretty well-known works of literature. 2 marks... I want to be told in what well-known work of literature the following appears or gets referred to. Beginning with Dennis Norden. A villainous squire, 144 pairs of green spectacles, and a hijacking in a post chaise.
I'm open to offers of help.
It must be Goldsmith.
Yes?
The grocer, green spectacles.
It must be Goldsmith, the grocer, Greenspan.
That's a very good start.
It's the Vicar of Wakefield.
The Vicar of Wakefield, according to Anne. I was absolutely stumped on that.
Yes, if you can give him the squire's name, you'll get your full 2 marks.
I know the principal. Yes.
Oh, it's the same name as a chap who used to paint numerous frescoes at about the same time. Would that help you?
Painted Hall, you mean?
Thorn something. Thornhill. Painted Hall of Greenspan.
That's right. You've got it between
Thornhill.
You. Thornhill. All right, yes, well, I think you can fought your way through. Yeah. 2 marks. Vicar of Wakefield, and published in 1766, was by Oliver Goldsmith. The villainous squire was Squire Thornhill. The green spectacles, believe it or not, were in exchange for a horse. And poor Sophia Primrose was forcibly carried off in a postchaise and finally rescued by a chap called Mr. Birchall. 2 marks. And now, Lewis Powell, it's your turn. A half-wit, an anti-popery riot, and a raven.
Well, that must be Dickens.
Yes.
It's Barnaby Rudge.
Yes. And the half-wit?
The half-wit was Barnaby Rudge.
Good enough. And the raven?
The raven was his raven. Was his pet.
Wasn't called Raven.
Wasn't it?
It was called Nevermore.
he kept quoting it.
Now he's got a very short name and more appropriate to a bulldog.
Bulldog?
Or a pair of pincers.
Snip?
No, no, I don't do that. I'm going to give you 1.5. What I was trying to get was grip. The raven in Dickens's Barnaby Rudge was the pet of poor Barnaby Rudge, who was a half-wit, and was called Grip. And the novel in general was told round about the anti-popery riots, which were called the Gordon riots. 1.5. Now, it's Frank Miller's turn. A doctor named Slop, a treatise...
Dr. Slop, yes.
...on noses, and an uncle who was wounded in the groin at the Battle of Namur.
Yes. These are characters from Tristram Shandy, by Lawrence Stern.
Yes.
One of the great sort of seminal... It's a terrible word, though, isn't it? Seminal books of English humour.
Yes.
And it sort of synthesized all the previous forms of humor of Rabelais and Cervantes, Don Quixote, and so forth. And it in this fantastic book, Tristram Shandy, which I do recommend you to sort of skip and plow and enjoy through, is all modern humor. It's a kind of send up of a novel. And it was written in the 1860s and 70s. 17th century. Terrific.
That's fine. I think you've got... Would you like to try and remember, because this is a much more difficult one, who was supposed to have written the treatise on noses?
No, it was one of those...
Very difficult ones.
Cod names.
That's right.
No. Well, yes, no.
This isn't essential. No. Well, he invented a character called Slawkenbergius.
Yes,
who was supposed to have written the treatise on noses. Anyway, you know everything about Tristram Shandy and get your 2 marks with great ease. And that's to Anne Scott James. And a student of natural philosophy, the Arctic Circle, and an assortment of human bones.
Absolutely baffled.
Now, wait a minute.
Yes.
The Arctic Circle.
Yes. The original Frankenstein.
Yes.
He chased him up. I think in a television version of it. The version where they chase the monster up to the Arctic Circle.
Right.
I don't think any of the film versions have ever done that.
Yep, they didn't.
Have they? Dillis?
No, they haven't.
No.
Never.
I wonder why not. That'd be a hell of a scene, wouldn't it?
Very good one.
Yeah. Mary Shelley.
Mary Shelley.
Yes, that's all right. And the bones just sort of get that bit of the ingredients right?
Well, it wasn't quite as Hammer Films made out in the original. It wasn't quite so technological, the reconstruction of the monster. It was simply a sort of do-it-yourself kit of human bone.
Absolutely right. Well done. 2 marks. Mary Shelley and all her chums had been telling ghost and horror stories, and they said, well, write this one down. And she did, and it became this very well-known novel, Frankenstein. Frankenstein was not the monster. This is what people mostly get wrong. He was a Genevan student, but he did learn the secret of imparting life into inanimate matter, and he went and dug up a lot of old bones in a churchyard, and he constructed the monster on the basis of these bones. And then he got away after having murdered Frankenstein's brother and his wife and chased him to the Arctic Circle. He was himself murdered by the monster, which then disappeared. Quite right, too. Well, now we have a round of difficult and paradoxical pronouncements, metaphors, some of them mixed, which are said or written by well-known people. And for 2 marks, I want you to guess at who said this and or wrote it. Dennis Norton, we begin with. You might as well fall flat on your face as lean over too far backwards. Oh. Good at dogs and women.
Herber?
Yes.
Yes. Was it one of the little sort of conclusions he drew at the end of, what was it, Fables for Our Time?
I think it's that one, yes, I think that's right.
The line that always sticks in my mind, and I really can't explain why, is in a short story where he says, his wife Marion entered the room at that moment, wearing dark glasses and showing her lower teeth.
That's right. Yes. Yes. Yes.
There was another beautiful line of Thurber's when he was interviewed on BBC Radio just before he died. And he said at one point in the interview, a woman's place is in the wrong.
In that same interview, there was one of the interviewers who said that he had been educated in France and had originally read Thurber in French. And it was only later in life that he'd come back to England and read him in English. And the funny thing was, he thought Thurber was funnier in the French. And Thurber says, that's been my trouble. I always lose a little in the original.
Well, again, a wealth of knowledge about Thurber, and 1.5 marks to Dennis. Dennis Powell, a verbal contract isn't worth the paper it's written on.
Include me out.
Yes.
Ah, yes. Mr. Sam Goldwyn.
Sam Goldwyn it is, and 2 marks. Frankly, I haven't been abroad so long that I almost speak English without an accent.
I haven't been abroad
so long that I almost speak English without an accent.
A large red tongue, gentlemen.
Yes. Nothing.
The chap who did those lovely little short folk. What's his name?
Short folk. Benchley.
That's what I want. Well done. well-known wit, Robert Benchley. 2 marks, I think, this time.
He was the one who when he went to Venice, cabled his travel agent, streets flooded with water, please advise.
And now Anne Scott-James. The United States went to Costa Rica like a shark with a checkbook in one hand and a hangman's noose in the other.
Ideological,
isn't
it?
Yes.
It's fairly sort of modern, very modern, last 15 years anyway. And the gentleman does not live very far away from Costa Rica.
Cortazar.
No, this is... he's not primarily a writer.
Oh, well. Yeah. Everybody's not doing? Primarily a writer.
What's he doing on this program?
It's only Frank and me left.
Well, he must be the president of a South American republic.
That's right, you're getting that.
Castro?
Yes.
It's Castro.
Oh, yes. We've made it, have we not?
Cuba, Fidel Castro, speaking unkindly about the United States. 2 marks. Well, now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the program, and on this occasion the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause of the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, your quotation was, "The game is up."
That is the perfect title for my book. I'm so grateful to you, Jack, for saying it. It's absolutely perfect. You see, I was thinking about writing a bestseller. It's cast, for instance, historically. You have to always have to be historical, really. And they've also got to be sort of vaguely connected with aristocracy. So my heroine is is a love child. He's always terribly sympathetic, you see. And her mother is Lady Caroline Mutton. She's a rather sort of older Lady Caroline Lamb. And the father is a sort of itinerant Grub Street writer. And he had a love affair with Lady Caroline Mutton, and his name was Thomas Tupper. That's a joke which will only be appreciated by farmers. But they have this child, and they, as is usual, she's put out to wet nurse, and eventually they persuade an innkeeper and his wife to adopt this child. And this innkeeper was Jabez Harp, who kept a little inn just around the back of Maiden Lane in the City of London. And she grew up a very gay, vivacious child. Extremely gay and extremely vivacious. And like all heroines of light love, she had an oval face. I can't really think of the alternative to an oval. We have a rectangular face. Parallelopipedian face. But she has an oval face and hazel eyes. I don't know what hazel eyes are. Her eyes look like a nut. And ringlets, and all the time she's laughing and terribly jolly and fun. So the Harps decide to call her, well, Ebony Jabez one day says, every time the wind blows and we're sad, she just sings. So they call her Aeolian Harp. It's a beautiful name. And then she goes on the stage, you see, in my story. And she joined a company of a marvellous actor called George Frederick Cook. And she played Sheridan's comedies with George Frederick Cook and went on tour in the provinces. It was the first Cook's tour, actually. And she was... But she had this sort of unremitting gaiety. And when he said, we have only taken 4 and 6, it was, what matters, all the world's a stage. And he took to drink. And he's actually one of the stage's most celebrated drunks, was George Frederick Cook. But at the same time, there was a man in the company who was a nobleman who always wanted to be an actor, called Lord Charles Grenville. And he was very much in love with her, but he couldn't stand this unremitting jollity. For 22 hours a day, she was happy and laughing and making little jokes. And eventually, although he loved her, and though he couldn't declare his passion, he went and joined the Navy. So he flung her out in the street. And she languishes there, this beautiful girl. And nobody will bother with her anymore. And she is really about to fling herself over what would be the embankment if the embankment had been built, which it hadn't been. When suddenly, there is a man in front of her that she recognises. It is Lord Charles. This ending's a bit like Fanny Hill, but I'm cribbing it, you know. It is Lord Charles, and he's come back from the Navy stone deaf. He was on the Victory with about to go to Trafalgar, and Lord Nelson said to him, will you get Lieutenant Farr, who was a gunnery officer? And he thought he was working with a gun, so Lord Charles put his head down the front of the bell and shouted Farr! And he went stone deaf, you see. So there he was on half pay, and there she is. So they get together, and it's she is the one he's always loved. And with her bright, unremitting chatter and this awful, glass-shattering laugh, he's the only man who can stand it because he's stone deaf. Now, you see, now that's my story, which is absolutely super. And I've got my nom de plume, which is Barbara Horsland. I want to be ahead of Barbara Cartland. And up to now, I've been stuck for a title for this thing. I was going to call it Aeolian Harp, The Study of a Regency Girl. And Jack gave me the title. I'm just going to call it simply The Gay Miss Harp.
Well, that's one heroine I hope I never meet. And we go on to Dennis Norton. If you remember, his line was, "A nightingale in the sycamore," which comes from Robert Louis Stevenson in Underwoods. Dennis.
I wish I could remember the name of that pub. I can't even remember the area it was in. Somewhere around Ladbroke Grove or Shepherd's Bush. Somewhere. It's terribly annoying, actually. You see, I've been asked to write an article in the series "The Most Unforgettable Character I've Ever Met." I can't remember him. I can remember him. I'll never forget him. It's where he was it'll come back to me. I know it was in a pub because I just bought a drink, you see, and I was astonished to see this elderly man at the other end of the bar holding an umbrella. You giggle, what do you think, what's astonishing about that? What was strange about that was that the umbrella was up. This old bloke was sitting at the end of the bar holding an open umbrella over himself. And what's more, it was one of those new type of umbrellas which come right down over your shoulders. You know the kind. It's like sort of plastic dome of St. Paul's. You know? And there he was, sitting inside it. And the remarkable part, this is a remarkable part, he was puffing at a pipe. Now, can you visualize what happens when a man smokes a pipe inside one of these transparent umbrellas? The whole upper half of his body simply disappears from view. The smoke just piled up inside the dome till eventually it was just like looking at a cumulus formation on top of a pair of grey flannel trousers. But that was nothing to what happened next. When the umbrella was completely full of smoke, he ducked out of it, then holding the umbrella so that none of the smoke escaped, he took from a carrier bag a large round plastic sheet with a little hole in the middle, and he slipped the hole over the handle of the umbrella, then he gradually worked the plastic circle up the dome and sealed it to the ends of the umbrella spokes, you know, you understand what I mean? So that all the smoke was now sealed inside this umbrella dome. And he put the whole thing on the floor and just sipped his beer as though nothing happened, you see? Well, I don't know whether you could have kept quiet and just sat there, but I couldn't. I said, excuse me, sir, I wonder you tell me, what's your racket? You know, to what purpose do you intend to put that umbrella full of smoke? And he was kind enough to explain. It all sort of fell into place. You see, the point of the whole thing was, many, many years ago, he'd been unfortunate enough to get married to one of those kind of women whose only response to any statement you make to her is some homely old saw or axiom. Do you know the kind of thing? If you were to rush in and say, "Oh, darling, we've lost all our savings, the baby's fallen out of the pram, and the bathroom's just caught fire." But she'd say something like, "Well, no use crying over spilt milk. Every cloud has a silver lining. Least said, soonest mended." 35 years I've lived with that, this old man said to me. It's been like cohabiting with the Oxford Book of English Quotations. He said, "So the day I retired from work, I made a vow, sir. I vowed I would dedicate the rest of my life to finding answers to them proverbs of hers." He said, "Now this," and he patted the umbrella. He said, "This is for the next time she comes out with, 'There's no smoke without fire.' Soon as she says it, out I'll go to my shed, bring in the umbrella, shove it in her face and say, 'What about this then, eh?'" I said, I see. I said, "Well, do you have other sort of ammunition in that shed?" He said, "Oh, I've got a few things, sir. There's a small round stone with a bit of moss on it. there's the 2 dozen eggs that I did manage to teach my grandmother to suck. and they are all in one basket, I might add. He said, well, it's been nice talking to you, Gav. He said, I must be shoving off. I'm making a wife a birthday present at the moment, a little purse. I said, it'll be nice. It's pricey, though. You wouldn't credit the cost of those sows these days. And I watched him leave, the most unforgettable character that I've ever met anyway. But where that pub was it at Maida Vale in the Red Lion? No, it comes back. I've got it. It was exactly where that quotation of Robert Louis Stevenson indicated. At Notting Hill in the Sycamore.
And I hate to think how many husbands and or wives are going to try this new game out. But by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story contest, and indeed he and Anne Scott-James also win the entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott-James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.